Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Good Thursday afternoon to you. Dennis Rodkin's in the studio. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business, and we'll talk to him. I want to start with politics, so we'll talk to him about that in just a few seconds. But also in the second half hour, we'll talk to Ian Schur about a number of stories that are in CNET this week. He's the senior editor at CNET, and one of them has to do with what's coming next with phones. It might be actually a foldable phone, so that your screen would fold. You could open it up and see it as one. Unfortunately, they're not doing it to make phones smaller. Looks like they're doing it to make screens bigger. So that's the next, and Elise Glink will be along as well to talk about marketing your small business in the new year. We start things off, though, with Dennis Rodkin, who you see at ChicagoBusiness.com and at Crane Chicago Business. Dennis, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, Steve.
All right, so your sort of real estate beat is center stage in the race for mayor this week, in a way. Christopher Kennedy talking about this gentrification. Now, he said that Mayor Emanuel is at the helm, and this is happening under his watch, so he should be responsible. He's not running against the mayor. But he said that what's happening is black people are being forced out. You watch real estate markets. You know who lives where.
Right.
Is there something to what he's saying?
I think it is inarguably true that black people are moving out. Several census reports and other forms of other sources of data have told us that the black population is shrinking in Chicago. I'm not equipped to say whether the mayor is at the top of an effort to force them out, but it is clear, you know, most of the schools that were closed, most of the CPS schools that were closed were in black neighborhoods.
But wouldn't they have been closed because the population had already moved out? I mean, there weren't people there. Right.
Well, okay. So this is what I'm saying. It is clear that the black population is shrinking, the white population is growing, the Asian American population of Chicago is growing fastest. I can't say whether I think Chris Kennedy is right that the mayor is trying to make that happen, but when you look at the numbers, there is no question that a change has been going on for several years now.
Are the African Americans who are leaving better off than those who are staying?
That's not something I could really respond to. I know WBEZ recently did a report saying that a lot of kids, black kids who leave Southside schools end up in in schools with similar problems in Indiana, in just east of the border. But I don't really,
right.
I don't know.
Right.
I'm not equipped to say, Steve.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. But the fact is that the numbers are shrinking.
And
there must be something behind the numbers.
Yeah, it's been true for quite a while. People have reported in many different ways that we are becoming a whiter city than we were.
It could be self-interest. I mean, if I have the means to get out and I'm living in a poor or bad neighborhood, I'm going to want to get out too.
And let's keep in mind that people aren't only leaving Chicago, but leaving Illinois overall.
Right.
It may be that people are leaving to follow jobs, which of course are more plentiful in the Southwest than they are in Chicago, in the southwestern part of the country. I don't mean on the Southwest side.
Yeah.
And that could be one reason people leave. But I think it could also be true. I mean, when you look at, and I do, when you look at some of the neighborhoods on the South Side that have been so slow to recover, I think if people are able to say, I'm out of here, then they do.
All right, let's talk about that, because we often talk about the Case-Shiller Index and how Chicago or Illinois, Chicago, has recovered very slowly from the housing crisis. You wrote just recently, right, about the numbers that were out in October.
Right. Yeah. Chicago continues to be right at the back of the pack, 19th or 20th out of the 20 cities in America. But the good news is, and it's not that I don't have to dig for the good news. I don't have to report positive news. But there was positive news in the latest figures, and that is, each of the past 5 months has been stronger than the one before on a year-over-year basis.
So they're not just going up. They're going up by more.
Right. They're going up by more each month. So, like, October was stronger compared to October 16 than September was compared to September 16. And that's good news. It does appear that recovery, we're still about 19% below our peak, and the nation is about 16% above its peak on prices. So we still have a ways to go, but it does appear that we're seeing recovering prices in neighborhoods that weren't getting it before.
Okay, so let's say, let's go over those numbers again. Mm-hmm. When you look at our peak, which would have been what, 2007, I think.
Right.
We are 18% housing value below where we were then.
Right.
Our and that's Chicago region.
That's Chicago region, yeah. And one thing to keep in mind is that, of course, the Roscoe Villages and Wicker Parks of the world are doing really, really well.
Right.
Wilmette, they're way up past where they were. But when you look at us as a market as a whole, an entire metro area, yeah, we're still well below our old peak.
18% below the peak. And if you look at the country
about
is 6% above
right.
its peak.
So that really what that suggests is that there's about a 24% percentage point gap between where we are and where we could be if we were acting like the rest of the country.
So you're saying that we're growing or improving at a stronger and stronger rate, 4.1% though, the national average was 6.2.
Right. Yeah, so while we are getting stronger each month, we're still weaker than the national figures.
All right, so Greg Hines wrote a piece then about real property tax values. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and Greg's been writing a lot about home values lately.
Yes.
And I have to read them very slowly because he writes complicated.
Yeah, I write, this house is pretty.
No,
Greg writes the much more complicated stuff.
Sort it out for me, though. So you look at the numbers, you look at what you're taxed and what your home value is, and you can see how it's changed historically. Put some meat on that.
Well, there are a couple of pieces to your property tax bill in Illinois. One is the value of your house. The other, or another, is what your taxing bodies want, what your school districts and mosquito districts and community college districts want. And while our home values were either falling or growing very slowly or not growing at all, those organizations continued to raise taxes in many cases because their costs go up because they're locked into union contracts or whatever it is. So they were asking for more taxes. Our taxes were going up even though our home values weren't. Finally, Greg reported in the past year, in most of the region, home values are going up faster than taxes because home values are rising enough. I'm sorry, home values are going up faster than tax rates because home values are rising enough that when they spread out what they need over every home, they can ask each home for less. However, it's not true in Chicago because we've had some of the biggest home value increases have been in Chicago, but there was that enormous property tax hike that came along at the same time that Chicago homes, as opposed to suburban homes, were reassessed. That's 2015. So that double whammy, which is exactly how we described it in 2015 in stories both Greg and I did, it's a double whammy. That has come in, and it keeps us from, keeps city homeowners from feeling that effect of declining tax rates that everybody else is.
So they're not feeling that benefit, and yet Greg also writes in the consumer, I forget who came out with the report, that Chicago's property tax, let me just read it.
It's important.
Even with the 2015 hike, Chicago homeowners are still getting a relative break.
Right.
According to the Federation, the effective tax rate lower only in Oak Brook. So we worry so much about Chicago property taxes. They're the lowest around.
And this is something something I've been hammering on for years and years, and everybody's surprised when I say it. Yes, property taxes are rising fast in the city of Chicago. However, they're lower than virtually every suburb in Cook County, nearly all in Lake and DuPage County. So while tax bills are going up fast in Chicago, that doesn't mean that you're paying more than you would if you moved out to the suburbs.
Right. The people who leave Chicago to escape property taxes, they're going to be in for a rude surprise.
Exactly.
All right, so let's bring that back then to where we started and the African-American population leaving. One of the things they talk about is the property tax burden.
Yeah.
It could still be, right? I mean, even though it's low, the property tax burden still could be chasing people out, or does that argument not hold as much?
Well, you know where that is strongest is outside the city in the South Cook County suburbs, where there has been just devastation of the job base and as a result of the real estate values. I mean, in some of the South Cook County suburbs, so many jobs were lost and so many homes went into foreclosure. Home values, as we've discussed in here, are still rolling backward into the
1990s. And that's what's bringing down the regional number that we talk about.
But those taxing bodies still need to open the doors of the school, still need to spray for mosquitoes, still need to run the library and the police and the fire. So the tax burden in the South Cook County suburbs is horrifying to some people. And I had a source refer to it in one story as a death spiral because taxes go up so much that people leave, and then as a result, taxes have to go up more because there are one fewer bodies to tax.
And people aren't going to move in.
No, in part, and that's something that a lot of the South Suburban governmental bodies are trying to work on is how do we attract people in here? One is we got to attract a jobs base.
Right. Dennis Rodkin, read more at ChicagoBusiness.com. We're going to take a break, come back, and talk about the realtor. Is the guy with the golden jacket or the woman with the golden jacket still around?
I don't know.
Century 21.
I mean, I have one, but you know, just for parties.
And thanks for wearing it today. I appreciate it. So we'll get to that. It's 12:22. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Dennis Rodkin in the studio writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. And, so I was talking about the Century 21, did they
old gold jacket. I haven't seen it in a long time. I think we're betraying our age.
Right.
That's sort of 70s, 80s.
Okay. So then, you know, in a way that's true because I was looking at this graph of what real estate brokerage firms are doing well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could have named Baird Warner, Coldwell. I guess I could name them all. But not if you would ask me who is doing the best, and the answer is At Properties.
Mm-hmm.
I would have never guessed that. Now, maybe are they in the northern suburbs? Maybe I wouldn't see them.
They are in the northern suburbs. They're not as dominant as that chart. Of course, this chart is just city, as you know from looking at it. They're not as dominant in the suburbs, but they're in the suburbs.
All right. So At Properties in the city is 20% of all sales go through At Properties.
Yeah. 20% of the volume went through At Properties in the city in 2017. That's twice, that's the next two, the number two and three companies combined didn't do as much.
And if you look at the graph, and you can at ChicagoBusiness.com.
Thank you.
All the others, save one, all the other companies are on a downward trajectory.
On their market share, right. They're still making more money, still doing more business because the city market has expanded. It's nearly doubled in the past, the value of all transactions combined has nearly doubled in the past 4 years. But what I'm looking at in that story is who's doing the most out of that pie, and At Properties has gone up, essentially has taken another percentage point per year each of the last 3 years, and at the same time, the numbers two and three firms, Coldwell Banker and Berkshire Hathaway, Koenig Rubloff, have gone down about a percentage point a year each year.
Well, the number five company, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that is actually going up from 3.5% to 4.5%,
uh-huh.
Not a lot, is this Jamison Sotheby's International Realty. Those are the big money houses, right? Is that right or no?
They have a pretty strong luxury bent. They were behind a recent sale, $2-3 million sales in the South Loop and things like that. Yeah, they have a pretty big luxury practice. And one thing to keep in mind is these numbers are just city. Jamison is very much a city boutique firm, while the other at properties, Berkshire, Coldwell, they're city and suburbs, though my numbers are only city. Some of them have much bigger shares out in the suburbs. Coldwell Banker has like 10% of the market in the suburbs and about 8% here. Jamison is barely in the suburbs.
You mentioned those $3 million sale in the South Loop, a condo, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the first $3 million sale since the condo next to it.
Since the condo next to it, yeah. A developer bought the two. That building has been through a lot. If we had an hour, we could talk about it. But the developer bought the whole floor, which was more than two condos. I think it was six. Turned them into these super lavish, two large, super lavish condos, and I duly reported that they were there. I had no idea what would happen. The first one went like that. Went for about 3.4 quickly. First time anything south of Roosevelt Road had ever sold for that. I'm sorry, second time. One had sold in Kenwood during the boom years. Nothing, $3 million sales on the north side into the north suburbs are pretty typical. That one went quickly. The second one was priced at over $4 million because the first one went so quickly. But something has changed, and that is that a 70-plus story building is going up right next door, likely to block the view, and it ended up going for only $3 million.
So for $3 million, you get the obstructive views of Hamilton, basically.
Basically.
It's sort of the same thing.
yeah, exactly. But you still see the park and everything.
And it's probably not too bad of a pad. Right? It's probably not bad.
It's nice. It's really nice. It's got a media room and also, and incredible views, just
Let's stay down there because we talked recently about the River City condos.
Yeah.
And their fight to go apartment or not go apartment. They finally voted to sell, and they're going to become an apartment building.
Yeah, right before Christmas, I think it was December 22nd, they voted. This had been going on, as you know from our discussions, this had been going on for about 2 years. Developer Mark Realty had made three offers, each one larger than the last, came through this fall with $100 million. And so Illinois condo law requires that if at least 75% of ownership votes to sell in bulk, then everybody has to sell. The other 25% have to go.
Right.
So that was why they were sort of working to get to the 75% threshold. Right before the sale, they were just barely over it. They hadn't reached it, obviously, in the first two votes. And then they came in well above. They came in at about 76, 77% right before Christmas, which means that all the condo owners will be selling to Mark Realty. Some of those owners I spoke to are going to stay as renters, but the whole thing becomes, as far as we know, the whole thing becomes rental. The one thing we need to be clear about is that Mark Realty hasn't commented on exactly what's going to happen. It's pretty clear they're going to go rental, but there could be a surprise in the last act.
Could they recondo it?
I mean, sure, but after spending all that money, what would be the point?
Right.
I mean, they're spending $100 million. The reason to buy a property like that is that it's cheaper to operate as rentals than as condominiums, and it's a great location, and there are all sorts of great reasons to operate it as rentals. I'm just saying, you know, there's always that chance that another shoe drops. I doubt it in this case.
You write this story about Bob Olson and his family. They like the neighborhood,
yeah.
So they're going to keep renting what they used to own.
What they used to own, yeah. They have three. They're going to sell all three and keep two of them for themselves and family members. And a lot of people were talking about that sort of thing. It will be, because prices have really been rising in the South Loop, and River City is relatively modest, just for lack of a better term,
sure.
Places, condos, most people will not be able to buy in the South Loop for what they get for selling their River City unit.
That's Dennis Rodkin. Read more at Chicago Business, or why don't you subscribe to Crane Chicago Business? How about that?
Thank you, Steve.
We'll talk to you again soon. The Wintrust Business Lunch on 720. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, the Consumer Electronics Show is starting, I think it starts on Sunday. And so we're going to be talking probably quite a lot about it over the next week or 10 days or so. And to be perfectly honest, I try to avoid talking about something that everyone else is talking about. So I do it with a little trepidation, but having said that, Ian Shura, senior editor at CNET, is on the phone line. And Ian, I hope you heard me there say, you know, the whole world starts to get involved in the Consumer Electronics Show. And sometimes I just feel like it gets a little overwhelming and I try to get away from it. Having said that, there certainly are things to take note of, right? Especially for guys like you.
Yeah.
You must get very excited about this.
Well, I definitely am excited to see the new technology. You know, I find that this event, it's kind of nerd Christmas, right? So there's definitely a lot of really cool devices that are shown off. Companies kind of tell us what they're planning for the next year. It's pretty fun. And you get a sense of what really wacky new ideas are out there. You know, this is the show where the Xbox was announced. This is the show where digital cameras really came into their own. And so a lot of the things that have changed the way that we live our lives and the way that we interact with technology happens here. So it's important to keep an eye on it.
Well, okay, so that was going to be my next question, and maybe you answered it, but how reliable is it? Because I think last year, maybe 2 years ago, we were talking about how it was going to be our introduction to virtual reality and that was going to sweep the nation.
Right.
It hasn't quite happened.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think that there are definitely one of the funner things that I like about CES is pointing out the failures that are announced and the products that don't end up succeeding. And look, this is part of any industry, right? You go to car shows and you see these way out there wacky cars that don't end up ever on the streets. So every industry does this. And part of this is to get themselves excited, to share ideas, to get, you know, to also the one-upmanship, right, that happens among some of the companies. So all of that happens. And so, you know, that's definitely part of the process.
All right, so what I read is one of the previews we're going to be getting at the CES this year is the future of 5G. We had 3, yeah. We have 4, 5G is coming, and you're here to tell me it is going to blow my mind.
Right, so it's more than just another G. So the thing about it is that it is obviously faster, but the real advancement that's coming from this, and admittedly it's been slow from the industry, but it's starting to really pick up, is that this technology is going to allow all of our devices to connect to the internet without even Wi-Fi. So imagine, for example, that your car, that your thermostat, that all sorts of stuff is able to do this. And the best part about it is that it's relatively low power. So it's going to be easier for these technologies to do this without having to suck down battery life and all sorts of stuff like that.
How is it going to connect? How is it going to connect without Wi-Fi?
So what's going to happen is it's actually cellular technology. It's the same stuff that gets your phone to the internet when you're not in your home. So, but what the difference is that for the longest time, we have been making it so that our cell phones and everything that connects to the internet through cellular data is running at about the same speed. And what they're going to be able to do with 5G is start segmenting it out and making it so that, for example, a medical device is able to send, like, tell you, you know, what you, if you have diabetes, tell you what your glucose levels are. It can send that to your doctor in real time through cellular connections and not use a lot of data versus your phone, which might want to stream video. And so they're going to create different connections that allow everything to work at the speed it needs to and thus make it a lot more efficient and much more reliable.
All right, so I'm reading about it, and one of the things they say is they say, think sensors on everything. Is that what you're just talking about?
Yep.
That everything's going to be connected in
exactly.
One way or another?
It's sensors everywhere. It's street lamps. Imagine just pretty much, you know, trash cans telling the sanitation department that they're full. It's going to be all sorts of stuff that we're going to see coming out there. And it's going to come in pieces, right? First, the technology has to launch. 5G is actually behind schedule already, which is frustrating. But, once it's launched, we're going to see cheaper devices. We're going to see cheaper chips. And it's going to be probably going to be expanding quite quickly once it happens.
I'm also reading that it could make possible, or more likely, remote surgical procedures.
Yes, because part of this is by controlling what connections there are and how reliable the connections need to be, right? If I have a glucose meter, it doesn't have to connect to the internet all the time. What they're going to be able to do is also create super high important connections. So that means that instead of having to worry about a drop call, right, you can have guaranteed stuff, and that means they're going to be able to start doing remote surgical procedures exactly, like to Africa or places where there may not be an easy accessible doctor. They're going to be able to do this stuff and have a connection they can rely upon.
Yeah, you don't want to see
really important.
You don't want to see the buffering wheel in the middle of an appendectomy. That would be a bad thing.
No, not at all. No, or in the middle of heart surgery. Absolutely not. And that's the important part, right? It's making this stuff reliable. And again, this is still, we're talking about 10 years in the making.
Okay, yeah. I want it. When can I get it?
Right. This is the first booms are happening now, where we're starting to see it. Like, you're going to start seeing phones come out with 5G in the next couple of years. And that'll be the first thing, because that's the easiest stuff, right? We all buy phones anyway. And then we're going to start seeing more and more devices get online, and eventually it'll be proven and they'll work out all the bugs, and that's when we're going to start seeing stuff like the remote medical stuff. But it's all going to happen in pieces because they have to, yeah, they have to get the technology rolled out, right? It doesn't happen
sure.
Just overnight.
And
they've
got to replace technology that exists or infrastructure that exists, all of that.
Exactly.
Okay, another thing that I'm reading, an article by Lin La, I think, at CNET.com, has to do with the fact that I read the headline. It says, a foldable Samsung Galaxy phone, ? I'm thinking, that's great,
yeah.
Man. I can make my phone a little smaller. It's going to fold up. I'm all for that. It's not about making them smaller.
Yeah, you want that.
Yeah.
It's not going to be. I'm sorry. That's not what you're going to get. So what they're going to do is that, at least the indications that we're getting, is that actually they're trying to make the phones bigger, not smaller. And what they're trying to do is make it so that they have basically on the front and back of your phone, there's a screen, and then you can split it apart and have basically a bigger screen. And they're thinking that they can do this partially because they've created new hinges that make it more possible. And battery technology, you know, advancements in how they manage batteries has gotten to a point where they can do this. It's going to be interesting and weird, and it's part of this kind of trend that we're seeing that we've written about on CNET before about companies trying to find new ways to sell phones to people because phones are kind of boring, right? They're glass on type of metal. Who cares? And so trying to come up with new technology that gets people excited is really going to be important.
So it sounds like what they're selling are tablet foldable tablets. If you want to fold a different way, they're taking a big tablet and folding it smaller.
Yes, it's almost, if you want to think about it that way, it's almost like a tablet that it folds into the size of a phone, which, you know, some people will want. If you look at, we have pictures on CNET of some of the ones we saw last year. It looks a little weird. I don't know how many people are gonna jump after this. But look, I've been wrong about consumer trends before. The big phone thing, a lot of people poo-pooed, and then it became huge. So maybe this will work.
So you're telling me though that it's not gonna, as a consumer, it's not gonna help me do much. It's just going to lure me into spending more with Samsung.
Well, I'm not gonna say it can't do much. There's a lot of, you know, whenever you change the technology as fundamentally as changing the screen size and stuff like that, you always see booms of new ideas come out. And so maybe they'll find ways to make that extra screen more useful than just having a bigger video, right? And so that's what would be interesting. But to do that, it's going to have to be widely accepted. We're going to have to start seeing more than just Samsung putting these types of devices out. And to do that, we're going to have to see consumer demand. So that's where it's going to get interesting, right? If Samsung puts this out later this year and people are really excited about it, then maybe we'll start seeing more people adopt it, and then we'll see more advancements in the technology.
We talk a lot about the responsibility of social networking companies, Facebook, Twitter, and all of that. And I don't know if YouTube as well. And there's this, what's his name, Logan Paul? Situation where he, you know, he filmed or videoed a suicide victim or a person who'd committed suicide, put it up on his blog or his YouTube page. He's a very popular YouTuber, and now there's this big kerfuffle about it. He's apologized. It seems to me like that's bad taste, but not something that you would crack down on if you're YouTube.
Well, so here's the problem. So first off, Logan Paul is one of the biggest YouTubers out there. He's fastest growing, I believe. 15 million people. He averages about 5 million views per video. And his audience is primarily younger. This is important. And so what he did is that he went to Japan. He, as you mentioned, filmed in a forest that has become a popular suicide spot, unfortunately. And a lot of people have written about it. And he stumbled upon a suicide victim. And he decided to post the video. In it, he actually laughs at this. I mean, again, it's a dead person.
Right.
And so it was extremely distasteful. And he's apologized profusely. The problem that he's running up against is, first off, we're talking about a children's entertainer doing this. And secondly, YouTube has rules about these types of things where they do not allow gory types of videos, sensationalist, disrespectful, graphic. And so one of the interesting things that's come out of this, other than, hey, Logan Paul, you're a moron for doing this, is that also, why has YouTube allowed this to happen? They put it, you know, this was the top trending video for a while. It had more than 500,000 people who had seen it. It was a huge video by the time it became a controversy. And that's part of what the debate is becoming about. It's not so much about, you know, a bad guy doing bad, because people do bad things all the time. It's about why isn't YouTube policing its service enough to make sure children aren't seeing dead bodies on their video.
So you're right. So it turns out I was wrong. This was a spot where YouTube really should have done something about it more quickly and showed still that these companies maybe aren't quite up to speed on that.
Right. And, you know, part of it is that they have teams that are supposed to protect these things. They have algorithms, right, computer programs that are supposed to filter these things out. There's a lot of questions about how in 2018, after we've dealt with so many things, we've dealt with beheading videos from ISIS.
Right.
We've dealt with terrorism attacks. We've dealt with all sorts of stuff. How in 2018 is this still happening? It's kind of mind-blowing.
All right. That is Ian Scher from CNET. You can read more about these stories at CNET.com. All right. It's a nerd Christmas coming up, so you enjoy it. And talk to me about the CES next week, okay?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Steve Alexander. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, 1252 on this Thursday afternoon. Elise Glink is on a phone line. And, well, Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch. How are you?
Thank you. Things are good. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you. I'm going to start running down all of the websites associated with Elise Glink. There is thinklink.com, bestmoneymoves.com. And I would imagine Best Money Moves, this is a key time for you as employers start to gear up the new year and with their employees. You know, I always think of as soon as really almost after Christmas, before New Year's, I start thinking about taxes and how I did for the year and start to prepare for that, start to stress out. And that's the sort of thing that Best Money Moves can help with if you're an employer and employee, correct?
It does. You know, everybody is pretty stressed out right now. Normally this time of year, we're just stressed about our credit card debt thanks to Christmas or the holidays and entertaining. We've kind of overindulged. And this year, everybody's very stressed out about taxes, and they're stressed out about their own personal money and how that'll change. And then if you want to buy a house this year, there's lots of stress going on. So, yes, Best Money Moves is designed to help.
How does that work? So it's something that the employers subscribe to or sign up for and then take it to their employees, correct?
That's right. So the employers that sign on with us feel that their employees are very stressed, and you know, and they know that when you're stressed, you're not really focused on your job.
Right.
And that can be critical if you're in manufacturing and on a line, or even if you're just in an office. And so they give them Best Money Moves, our tools and our technology, and then that helps the employee measure where financial stress is really extraordinarily high. And then we use machine learning technology to send them solutions that are personalized and helpful.
So it's been up and running, great success over the past couple of years. I'm wondering what you have learned. You must have learned something about us as workers and our stress levels that maybe you weren't expecting.
You know, I think what's interesting is that we've got companies that are signed on in Chicago, in Atlanta, in D.C., in Denver, and in San Francisco. Those are our five communities right now. And what we've noticed is that the stressors are different in every single city, and
really,
they're different based on the age of the employees. And it's been really interesting to work with these different companies in these different areas. And it's funny because we've got three companies in Denver, and for all of them, housing is the top stressor because you can't buy anything there.
Interesting, right. So I could see, I understand the differences in age. That makes perfect sense to me. But the differences in geography just has to do, obviously, with local issues. Real estate's one. What are some of the other things you've seen?
Well, we've seen that the actual cost of living, you know, beyond housing, which of course is usually your biggest line item, the overall cost of housing is, is pretty impactful when it comes to feeling financial stress. Because what you're trying to do, even if you're not trying to keep up with your neighbors, the Joneses or the Smiths, what you are trying to do is reach your own personal goals for your finances. And so, as you start this new year, there's lots of talk about going back to the gym to shrink your, you know, tighten the belt.
Right.
We want you to tighten the belt as well when it comes to your money.
All right, Best Money Moves is the site if you're interested. You don't have to be a boss, right? You can check it out if you're an employee and then take it to your boss. You wouldn't argue with that, would you, Elise?
No, be all good.
All right, so here's the thing that I wanted to talk with you about in the time we have, and this is partly personal, but, you know, I have a small business, SteveBertrandTravel.com, and I'm trying to figure out ways to get the word out, to spread what I do. Really, the hardest part for me, I think, is to explain what I do, because it's not the way it appears at first blush. So, one of the things you suggested is, you know, create a video. And my daughter, Emma, who's doing this at school, actually created a very nice video. It's up on my Facebook page. You can check it out. I showed it to you. You had nice things to say about it. And then you said, get it out there. I said, yeah, get it out there. And then I realized, I'm not sure what get it out there means.
Well, it's interesting. I think that, you know, when you're lucky enough to already have some people on a mailing list like you do, or other ways to broadcast messages, I think small business owners really need to make better use of those tools that we already have built in. And so one way is, if you have a decent following on your Facebook page, use it. You've got your video up there. You spend a few bucks to promote that and get that out. And you can go behind the scenes in Facebook when you're buying ads on it and be very, very specific about who you want to see it. Likewise, if you've got a newsletter list, this is a perfect opportunity to do a newsletter all about your video and then include it in newsletters that are going forward and ask people to forward it to other people who may be interested in doing the kinds of tours and trips that you do. And for any small business owner out there, you know, you really have to make use with what you have. And so whether it's existing clients or it's offering deals and discounts to future clients, or if they, you know, they get a coupon, if they forward your email to somebody and then they come back, there's really inexpensive retargeting things that are available. And as small business owners, you've got to make use of those.
And so are you talking about MailChimp and things like that?
Sure. MailChimp is a good one. HubSpot, which is kind of a, I think more of a modern Salesforce.com, is a really interesting tool. And for as little as $50 a month, you can put their code on your website and see who's coming through. You can help generate more newsletter signups. You can advertise different kinds of deals that you're offering as a small business owner. And then all of that information comes back to you in a usable format. And I think that it's those kinds of tools that give you leverage.
I would imagine, too, though, you want to use the what you've created with newsletters or whatever, but you don't want to overwhelm. I mean, you're like, you know, someone saying, oh, here comes that video again, or I've seen this video too many times, or something like that.
Well, you can change the video. So you can change the image that's on the video, because even though you feel like you're sending it out every week and you probably read your own newsletters like I do every week, you know, really when you look at how many people open it up, how many people scroll through and get to the bottom of that newsletter, where the clicks are, what you might see is you might get a 15 to 25% open rate, which means that three quarters of the people or more didn't even open your newsletter. And so coming up with new and interesting content, in your case, Steve, I would be telling stories about, you know, two times a week about the different trips and tours that you've taken, the ones you've planned for the upcoming year. I would do testimonials, a really powerful motivator, and I would have people who have been on your tour. I'd recycle some of those testimonials from your website, bring them back in. And so if you're creative, two or three times a week, you're reaching out with what feels like very new, fresh, interesting information, and that's what gets people to open up your newsletter.
Elise Glink, thinklink.com. Thanks for joining us today. We'll talk again next week.